for you is a question that's sometimes annoying to hear, but I think it's something that lots of audience people, including me, like to know. You said the page is never really blank, and everything is waiting there. So maybe, can you speak to the moment before marking the page? And for some people, we think of it as writer's block, when you cannot write, and then the magic happens when you make the mark on the page. So just a little bit about how you think, the process of between thinking and writing, like when you get to the writing.
Okay. Thank you. Trust a writer to be tricky. the nicest feeling is what I said, when there's that urgency and you just have to get something down. It can be the tiniest of fragments, you know, it can be four words. But once that's there, I find that's pretty foolproof. I can go back and work on it and it'll be alive still. Yeah. Outside of that, I'm scared of the blank page sometimes, you know, start a new essay or something. I don't know who it was, like, there's a trick, I think it was Fitzgerald who said, like, never, always stop when you know what's going to happen next, right? And then you come back the next day, you're okay. But, you know, the beauty of writing is you can mess up almost infinitely, right? And it just, you can just take care of it right there on the page. You know, the error and it's not a performance that's marked by that kind of timing and fallibility, right? And I think that's always important to remember. You just have to make it exist, then you can make it better. But sometimes that first part is really rusty. Like Stephen Hyten, I think, compared it to somewhere in one of his books, he says it's like turning on an old tap and the water runs brown and then it runs clear. But you have to turn on the tap. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I have a question. I like to read bibliographies and your references. I was curious. Some of them I know, some of them I don't know. Could you talk about how you got your references? Did they just come to you? Did they guide you? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. Let's get to the fact again. I mean, some of this talk, I have to say, this is like the deep, you know, these are not things I've sort of researched together this term. Like, this is my writing life. So when it comes to Etty Hillison, something like that, like I've read everything by her and about her, that kind of, and probably the same is true with James Baldwin. And then, three of those are artist books, so are the visual artists, that's the Islamic Art and Culture, the Illustrator's Notebook, and everything she touched are referring to the visual works that I referenced. Julie Sedeby's a linguist. I'll be interviewing her this week in Toronto. It's interesting how she comes at language questions from a scientific perspective, and mine is more poetic and intuitive, but like our books do really meet in the middle, so that's where that comes from. Oh, I referenced the painting by Mother Williamson. Dionne Brandt, I hope, speaks for it, so just has to be there. I'm sorry, that's not a very... What, do you have a further question
so
about it?
Okay, so maybe I need to rephrase. So, did you find these people led you in different directions while you were thinking of them, or did you write and go back to them? Is that what
you mean? It's some of each, but generally I write first, because like if there's a kind of secret mission to my writing, I would say it is to restore some of our inner agency, or to say, like, the way that a subject moves you, the way that you think through it is significant. It matters. And that we don't always come at it through the lens of expertise first. Yeah. And I care about that, not so much as, like, for me to convey the story, but for the reader to visit their own with that kind of permission. Yeah, and so I don't mean to understate, like, how important reading is and how important all these ideas have been to me. And I am in conversation with them once I start writing and looking at them. But I try to get as far as I can without them first.
Thank you for your talk and sharing your words today. We can build on that Sam said earlier about how your comments about the page being that which draws from you and that you can give to. I'm curious about your relationship with yourself as being the vessel that the page, like kind of the pen that the page draws the ink from. And so your relationship with the emptying onto the page and kind of how you kind of emotionally relate to that experience.
Okay.
If that might be too intimate, I understand also. But I'm just curious about, like, I have been giving thought to kind of like vulnerability hangovers. Sometimes when we empty ourselves so much and it feels so hot and so good, but afterwards you're like, well, now that that's out of my body, who am I here? And like, so that kind of like balancing act, I'm just curious if that's part of your process.
Yeah, that's a good question too. I mean, I write very confessionally, but I'm kind of a private person. And so I've just come to accept that. The page is going to contain all kinds of things that I would never say necessarily, especially not to strangers, right? So, like, I think that relationship is just, yeah, that's just how it is for my writing. As far as how that makes me feel, I mean, I don't find writing cathartic. I don't write, this is, you know, it can be for people. I don't write that way, that it just pours out of me and I'm like, okay, I told my story. But what I think has at times, you know, been personally, emotionally beneficial is that, like, I'm trying not to, like, stray into too romantic a concept. But there is something about the page that, in, like, you have to tell the truth. It doesn't have to be the facts, but, like, it won't let you lie on a certain kind of metaphysical level. And if you are lying, you will know it, and the reader will know it, and it'll just sit there until you get it right, you know? And sometimes the return is, like, 10 years for a recent piece that I published, but that's helpful, because you can't stick to the rote story that you might, if it's about your own life, or, you know, you have to actually change it to make it make sense. And that can be a corrective that's, yeah, personally helpful.
Well, knowing that we have some additional time to actually spend in more intimate conversation, I'll just say if there's an urgent question that needs to be asked, I'll invite it now. But barring that, and before we thank our speaker for a beautifully crafted and brilliant talk, I have some logistics to go over with you. So first of all, to Jesse, who's not paying attention to me right now, who was fully in charge of operationalizing all of this today, thank you so much. Steve Page and the Page family for supporting this wonderful event every year. It is a true event. Okay, so we have coffee and tea and alcoholic beverages for sale. Hors d'oeuvres are coming through. For my friends to my left, if you could just move those chairs kind of over here out of the way so we have clean pathway. And my friends over to my right, if you can maybe move those just against the wall here and open up the door to the balcony if people want to wander out that way. We'll have some hors d'oeuvres coming through. We'll have a conversation. Please join me in thanking Sneaky DeMeyer for that.
And begun at the top of the first hour from an October 29th event that was held in Watson Hall at Queen's University. And as introduced by, who you just heard as well, who emceed the event, but was introduced by, who also introduced the event, maybe that's what I should say, was Sam McCagney, head of Queen's Department of English. And you heard Kingston Poet Laureate Sadiqa Day Meyer deliver her page lecture called In the Field, and that is in part of that annual series of lectures held at Queen's University every fall. And again, she was introduced by Sam McCagney. First of all, I should do the time. It's 11 minutes, just turned 11 minutes after 5 o'clock. First of all, my heartfelt thanks to all of you for having tuned in to this first segment of this show, so first hour plus, and my thanks to the Page Lecture Series for its existence and longevity, and to Sadiqa for her incredible lecture in it this year, and to Sam and all at Queen's for making it all happen. And there was a huge crowd there, to the crowd who came out to be there and part of it that day. And before we move more fully into the next hour and the feature there, I really almost have to do this first. So here we go.
2 out of 3 geese. 6 out of 7 seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house.
Late in the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather, a place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
And you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And just a quick reminder that each week, both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Excuse me, they will remain there for 3 years. And now, as at about almost 15 minutes after 5 o'clock, into this second hour, and we're going to move now into, I should just say, from a December 3rd event that was held at Novel Idea Bookstore. You're going to hear Julie Salverson reading from and launching her new book, A Necessary Distance, Confessions of a Scriptwriter's Daughter. She was introduced that evening by Carolyn Smart, tell you what, let's just jump into it. And of course, the first voice you will hear then will be that of Carolyn Smart. Here we go.
Done. My name is Carolyn Smart, and it is my great pleasure to be introducing this evening. It's an honor to introduce Julie Salverson at her hometown launch of A Necessary Distance. I must say that this reminds me of a reading I attended at Harbourfront in Toronto many years ago, when the Liverpool sound poet Adrian Henry was the opening act of Czesław Miłosz, who'd been announced as the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature mere days before. Adrian said that he felt like the cart before the Lord Mayor's carriage. My roots are also from Liverpool, but the other similarity here is that Miłosz was described as a writer of uncompromising clear-sightedness, and I believe that aptly describes Julie as well. I first met her nearly 20 years ago when she led a group of drama students in a performance during the Common Magic Conference in honor of Bronwyn Wallace and the 20th anniversary of Women's Studies at Queen's University. Her reputation had preceded the meeting. She was known to me as a generous-hearted, fiercely dedicated social activist and scholar who was a mentor to many students. I'm proud to say over the years she has become my trusted friend and in fact introduced me at my own hometown book launch several years ago. Her previous book, Lines of Flight, revealed her courageousness and relentless search to reveal the untold and often painful stories. This new book is also a journey and a perilous one, as it involves personal discovery and at times uncomfortable truths about her own family. It's a study of her writer father's long and wild trip around the world in 1963, researching world hunger for a CBC documentary. She has described what she discovered, and in particular the reading of her father's seven journals, as both appalling and inspiring. You'll hear more from Julie herself now, but to come back to where I started, as journeys often do, I want to say what a true honor it is to introduce someone with such courage, commitment, and dedication. Please welcome Julie Salverson.
I wasn't that nervous before. Thank you. And thank you, and thank you. Thank you, Oscar, for this amazing institution of Kingston, without which all of us would just go down the drain immediately. I'm going to read a couple of short pieces. A couple of short pieces. And we're going to play a tiny clip from one of the plays that my dad wrote. A tiny, tiny clip. So my dad, at almost 89 years old, died in 2005, and it took me 9 years to get the nerve to open up the few boxes he left. Probably that's not unfamiliar to some of you. So my friend Kip Pegley, who some of you know, called me up one day and said, I'm coming over with magic markers and we're going to go through the damn boxes. And in the damn boxes, I found these seven notebooks that Carolyn mentioned. And I discovered that my dad had made this trip in 1963 around the world in 10 weeks writing a documentary on world hunger. And what they were doing was they were not looking at what was wrong, they were looking at where people were fixing it. So that's what they were looking for. So I'm kind of gobsmacked at this, and my husband Bill says, well, your last book was this following uranium all around the world. There's your next trip right here. And immediately, not that I was going to get on a lot of planes, but immediately I was going to get on some kind of journey. So, the first part of this that I'm going to read you is from very early on in the book. The first thing I remember of my father's trip around the world is mashed peas. Shortly after returning home, he fell ill. There were mysterious conversations in the hallway outside my parents' room, and an unprecedented home visit by Dr. Vail, our family doctor. Dad had contracted hepatitis in Jakarta. He was sentenced to bed rest and a diet of peas, which I would prepare by mixing the canned vegetables into a gray medicine. This all seemed very glamorous, the abrupt departure 3 months before, the colorful postcards with exotic stamps, and now this mysterious illness. Nobody in our family, and nobody we spoke to during that time, had even heard of Jakarta. Now, in 2014, Dad's 7 battered, black-covered notebooks pulse in the corner of my study. I can't bring myself to read past the beginning and a few sporadic pages, glimpses of the trip. The cultural moment in which I open these pages is a murky surface that separates me from the water in which he swam. What is a first impression? An unexamined look before analysis. The brain is hasty. In a split second, it recognizes and files away information that shocks or calms, provokes or reassures. First responses. 1. The books vibrate with energy, movement. The man is present. 2. He is private, careful about the level of sharing with his colleagues. It's only with his notebooks that he shares his increasing discomfort as his perceptions of his fellow humans change. These are not the notes he would have been making about the script. These, I presume, were lost or more likely became the script and then were discarded once editing was done. 3. What are my responsibilities to his privacy? Does blood lineage allow me a certain permission? The notebooks feel like an inheritance, an imperative, one that must be honored, and I'm not looking back, tracing my ancestry. The direction is different. The notebooks reach forward and make a claim. Do I seal them away, preserve them, or do I break them open, seed them into a story? It's already too late. I'm a witness now. I read a short section that Dad wrote in Nairobi. He's come from Jakarta, and he's in the capital a few days before flying to the Serengeti. I'm impressed with his candor and honesty. He's distressed at his reactions as a foreigner. He observes how his Scandinavian background shapes his responses to this environment. He reflects astutely on what he brings to the process of steadying himself as he spins off-center in his new surroundings. As I read, he comes into view across the years, opening his veins and revealing himself, thinking, of course, that nobody will read it. Although, a few comments suggest that, well, somebody might. He is, after all, a professional writer. He's used to an audience. So on January 16th, 1963, he sets out with Jean Lawrence, director, and Graham Woods, cinematographer. And from then, until a Saturday evening in 2005, when he turned to open a bottle of rum and fell dead to the floor of his downtown Toronto apartment, he kept the notebooks. He kept them despite a lifetime habit of economy, despite often throwing out what he was sure nobody would want, and despite a habit of disregarding the past, as surely as his Icelandic grandparents had turned their faces toward a new country. "We are Canadians," his Aunt Dora told him in 1921. "This is our country now. We learn its ways and we give it our labor." So each time my family moved, each time my father emptied his files, he kept the notebooks. They held something he wasn't prepared to let go of, something he didn't want to forget. Perhaps he wanted someone to know. Of the over 1,000 scripts my father wrote, of all the projects of a lifetime, it was this story that he kept. And at this thought, I get a glimpse of what I want to offer him. I decide to write the story of encountering my father through reading his journals. What will I find? Can I present him as an honest man living in 1963, stumbling through the territory of newness, of his own disorientation, to show how he sees the worlds he is meeting for the first time? The heart of my father's blind spots and vulnerability then, meeting the times I am living in now. I would like to invite him into the future. So I'm going to read one other section. Yeah. So my husband and I had a disagreement about what scene I would read last. And it went on for a little while. And so it's one of those things where you just have to trust your gut and not always your husband. So There are a number of people in this room who are in this book because it's kind of how I write. There was a whole pandemic journal, most of which my publisher was wise enough to tell me to chuck. But there's some of it still there because I tend to write about what's going on as I'm encountering something. So this is a scene that takes place at the barn where my horse used to be and involves...
Page number, please.
Yes, 157. I should have done that before. Thanks, Jill. 157. So I have a good friend who's part of this book, and she's in this scene, and I won't tell you who she is till after. So prepare to be embarrassed, but I won't say anything now. Because I would go for walks with her, and I would try to figure out what on earth I was doing, and there's a previous scene before this one where we walk with her and her dogs, and I say things like, what's racism anyway? What is it? What's going on with my father in these different encounters? So this is the scene where we go to the barn. And one more thing I'll say to set the scene up. I've been fortunate enough to have a few interviews about this book, kind of astonishing thing. And people say, well, what's relevant now? Or what's important to you about it? And I found myself saying to someone the other day, what's important to me about it is that my father kept examining his assumptions and kept asking more questions and let himself make notes and figure things out and wait until he knew the next thing. And I just retired from Queens, but my students, they have to know right away what they think. They have to press like or not press like, and they have to have an opinion and they have the judgment. So that's why this scene matters. It's sort of about that. Bill comes with me to the barn. I'll ride my horse Henry with Diana and her mare, and Bill will fix some horse blankets in the sewing machine room he's set up beside the viewing lounge. An hour or so later, after our ride, I'm pulling the saddle off Henry's warm back and I call to Diana in the next stall. I have a question before you go. She comes over and stands with her COVID-19 mask slightly floppy on her face and her hair flat with helmet head. I ask her the question. Who would want to know about a white guy in his 40s? She thinks for a moment. Well, maybe what he says is a red herring. Maybe that's not what you want people to think about. Diana asked me what the point of the book is, what message I want to get across. This soundbite question irritates me, and I snap back. You mean what, Reader's Digest paragraph explains it all to everyone? I get angry so fast these days. A flash storm, bang. I take a breath. This is Diana, I remind myself. And I can answer this question, can't I? I say, people are complicated. People can do terrible things, dreadful, vicious things, also unbearably kind and generous things. And it's the same person. Diana leans on the stall door. Henry noses her arm, looking for a treat. But what you're writing about isn't really what your dad did, is it? It's what he wrote. And it's his private notes, right? Not what he decided to publish. We all think so many things, and they aren't... Well, it doesn't mean they are what we think. They're how we find what we think. Henry is now nuzzling my pocket, and I give him the peppermint mints I'd forgotten were there. I pull off his sheepskin and saddle blanket. I put everything on the stall door. What would it mean if we couldn't think thoughts, any thoughts, and couldn't put them down in private notebooks as we tried to make sense of what we were feeling? What would it mean for this not to be possible or permitted? It would be like when I was a child and then a teenager, so afraid my diaries would be seen and judged that I wrote in code to protect myself. When I became an adult, I didn't know how to excavate my own convictions or even desires. I was too good at writing down what others wanted me to say. Diana is still thinking. You know, the other day I was riding around the driveway, just hacking. Morag, our coach, Morag knew I wanted to fix my riding position. I was leaning too far off center. She told me, while you're riding, close your eyes. Lean forward, far. Lean backward, far. Do this a number of times. When you open your eyes, you'll be in the middle. Isn't that what your dad was doing? I wouldn't know I was off balance if I didn't try to lean too far forward and too far back. I decide this is a good analogy. My father's notes are private, only for himself. He's leaning forward and back, thinking with his eyes closed. So where are you, Diana? Where are you? There you are. So that's all I'm going to read. But what I thought I would do, so I was inspired by Joanna's cookbook, because Joanna launched a cookbook a few weeks ago, and there were all these samples. And I was in the bookstore later because I couldn't come, and I was saying to Oscar, we're so sorry we missed it. Well, obviously we're sorry we missed the launch, but we're really sorry we missed the samples. And I realized I could bring a sample. So my dad was, part of the book was me discovering how much a part he was of early CBC. And he wrote for something called the CBC Stages, which were through the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. These were, for a long time, live radio broadcasts. Dad said he'd have sort of the day off on Monday and he'd think about something. Tuesday he'd go in and pitch an idea. Wednesday and Thursday he'd write it. Friday and Saturday they'd rehearse it with live orchestra Saturday night. And Sunday it went on air. So I have a bunch of those, and the thing is, I think over the next while, through the winter, I want to have a few gatherings in my house. And if anyone would like to come and hear a radio play, drop me an email or a note, because I really think it would be fun. And they can't be played because we have a lot of good but not always good copyright stuff. So unlike the States, where all the stuff is on the air and everyone's heard of it, ours are not been heard of. So this is a show. This is a show that my dad found some diaries from a 1930s farmer in Upper Canada. And he was interested in this story of this farmer. The Quakers had sent this farmer an escaped slave who'd come up through the Underground Railroad. And my dad decided he wanted to write a story about this. So I'll just say a little bit about the people involved in this. Andrew Allen. For some of us who are of a certain vintage, Andrew Allen basically formed the CBC Drama Radio Group, who were the first theater company in Canada, absolutely. They were known around the world. One of the actors, John Drainey, was considered by many to be the greatest radio actor in the world. And John Drainey is in this. My dad wrote it. Andrew directed it. A name that you won't hear, but you might recognize some of you, is Robert Christie. Another is Tommy Tweed. Another is... Billy Richards. And there was a famous show called Jake and the Kid, and that was John Drainey and Billy Richards, and that's the Billy Richards you'll hear. So I could talk about this for far too long, and so shall I push play?
Yes, press the button.
It's so wonderfully old-fashioned.
CBC Stage. On CBC Stage, our radio drama showcase, Playbill 11, Night's River, a new play for radio by George Salverson, with music composed and conducted by Morris Servin. Production and direction, Andrew Allen. Presenting John Drainey as Solomon, Tommy Tweed as Duff, and Billy Richards as Roby in Night's River by George Salverson.
Forest. sitting on a stump, mumbling a song and munching a piece of bark. That'll be back in 1825, about 9 years before Toronto got its name back, though my father, like some others, would never call it York. Why, that was even before they built the road from Yonge Street to my father's farm, cutting through that colossal virgin forest. I remember that because it was on the old Ox Sledge Trail where I came upon the king. He's there in my mind to this day, that strange man, unlike any in my world. There he sits, all alone, in the prehistoric woodland. Wait for the king. Wait for the king. Yes, that was before the road. My father never wanted the road before the king came. People come down a road. He didn't want people coming down a road. And he never went out from the farm, except sometimes for supplies. And of course, Sundays. Sundays, we always went out, just the two of us, boy and man, to the little church that used to be on Yonge Street past Brody's Tavern. Pa would only nod at people who used to be his friends. After the service, we'd go alone into the little cemetery where the big elms stood around, lifting their arms. Pa would stand there, looking at the headstone. I'd do the same, standing and praying. Pa was a man who would pray, but never kneel, not even to God. We'd stand there, all of us, boy, man, and reaching elms, all praying to heaven.
For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen. Pa?
Well?
Can Mom hear us when we pray here?
No, Ruby.
Then why do we do it?
Well, we pray for her. So?
But it's been so long now.
That makes no difference.
But God must have made up his mind by now.
What's that?
Well, suppose God met Mom when she came to him. He must have heard us praying then, and he must have figured out right away that Mom was good. And if he did that, he wouldn't change his mind, would he? So he'd have to go on praying for her?
You're being fanciful again.
But what would Mom do in heaven to make God change his mind?
Stop it. Not in this place.
I only wonder.
It's our responsibility. When you take on responsibility for another person, it stays with you all the days of your life. Yes, I was responsible for her. Yeah. And she died.
Fade it out. Slow fade out.
Well,
yeah. So if anybody wants to hear the whole thing, come over in January. And
how long are the plays?
The plays are a little bit under an hour. And actually, Michael Draney, John Draney's son, and I, together a number of years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, played them for a while. Over about a two-year period, and it was long enough ago that some of the people in them were still alive. And they never heard them, because they were busy doing them. So it was really remarkable. They came, a number of people came and heard them for the first time. We called it Speakeasy Radio. I told Michael I wanted to do Speakeasy Radio again. So we will. So,
well,
I think, I don't know if you want to do any questions or just let people, it's probably...
One thing I noticed,
yes,
is that you said you were worried about dipping into your father's diaries, but he obviously was not worried about dipping into the diary of this farmer.
Right, right, for sure.
So
yeah,
that
yeah.
Give you license. That's
really interesting. I never thought of that.
Repeat the question.
Joanne was just saying that I was. You know what? I actually never was worried. Well, it's really interesting thing of the dynamic of working with his notebooks.
Right.
But she was saying, I'd said, you know, do I have the right to do this? And my dad found it. I mean, he found a diary in an archive, and he used it. And knowing my dad, he transformed it as best he could to a story that he felt he could tell.
Right.
So he never thought he was supposed to exactly tell the farmer's story because he knew he couldn't. I feel like we've forgotten that we actually can't. As we're so busy trying to be verbatim authentic, but that's another story.
Well,
talking, we should stop, and everybody should get to stretch. And thank you so much. It means
thank
the world
you,
to me that
thank
you came.
You.
Yes?
Don't you want to read some more?
No, you can read it.
She wants you to read it.
You know what I'll do? I'm going to read you a limerick. I will read you a limerick. My dad started writing limericks to keep himself sane, and it became Around the World in 100 Limericks, so I'll finish with a limerick.
Perfect.
People who fly the Pacific like things to be pretty specific. If the plane is to crash, it should make a big splash. If it doesn't, the trip is terrific.
And you just heard from a December 3rd event held at Novel Idea Bookstore. And as introduced by Carolyn Smart, you heard Julie Salverson reading from and launching A Necessary Distance, Confessions of a Scriptwriter's Daughter. And it is now 41 minutes after 5 o'clock. I tell you what, let's do this. I'll be right back.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Have you been dumped? Left all alone? Just want to find your soulmate? Look no further, because your new best friend is waiting for you at the Kingston Humane Society. The Kingston Humane Society is a nonprofit animal organization founded in 1884 that is supported solely by the community, receiving no government funding to assist in their mission of caring for injured, abused, and homeless animals, with the goal of creating families and homes for the animals. They are the only open shelter in the region, accepting every animal brought to them with compassion, respect, and humane assistance. If you want to donate to help these animals find their best friends, or if you're interested in finding the new love of your life, please visit KingstonHumaneSociety.ca. Everyone just needs a little love.
Listen to Let It Happen on Saturdays at 1 p.m. till 2 p.m. for a little bit of psych, a little bit of pop, and a whole lot of... And that's only on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good morning, Kingston. This is your indie wake-up call. Playing anything new and everything indie. Garage rock, hip-hop, folk, punk, and electropop. New, Canadian, and even local. Indie Wake Up handles your morning. Here for you, Kingston. Weekday mornings from 8 to 10. On the one, the only, CFRC 101.9 FM.
And, my heartfelt thanks to all of you out there who have tuned into the show today. I'm going to, I've got a little bit of time here. I'm going to share a few upcoming events, maybe a call for submissions or two as well. But before I do that, I'm also going to end with a song today. So quite a long song as well. So maybe you can stay tuned for all of that. What I would like to do is just again say my heartfelt thanks for all of you for having tuned in, and an equal thanks in this second hour here to Julie Salverson and her wonderful reading and sharing that clip and as part of her launch event. And to Novel Idea Bookstore, who always helps support the lit community for all they do. And to all of those who came out to support that evening, and for also giving me, Julie, giving me permission to air that event. I do plan on airing a song, as I mentioned, at the end of the hour. I won't give it... I'll just save the suspense, and I won't tell you what it is until we get there. How's that? But I'm going to, before I share the upcoming events that I mentioned, I do want to kind of do a quick sort of brief close just to let you know, and so I don't run out of time, because sometimes I just ramble on. But what I need to say is you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC. 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock, and we do stream live online at www.cfrc.ca. And the usual reminder, both hours of this show each week are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They will remain there for 4 years. And I'll just shoot this out here, too. It's what I always say near the end of the show. Please do also stay tuned for at the top of the hour for 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music. That's hosted by Rob Carnell. And I do hope you can tune in again next week. I'm going to go ahead and pull up that sheet now that I brought in. There is actually an event. Got a couple, some events happening already. Here it is, the first of the year. There's kind of a lull there towards the end of December, but it did allow me to get that last book launch that I hadn't gotten aired in, that Julie's book launch. So I was so excited to be able to do that today. I will tell you, the show next week will air the December and the Journey Continues monthly open mic reading. It will air that event held at the Elm Cafe ahead. Well, why don't we just read through the list? We'll get to it, Bruce. Okay, coming up actually this Sunday, and not here in Kingston, this actually in Hamilton. Lit Live runs at the, I'm hoping all this information too is still current, runs at the Staircase Cafe and Theater on usually the first Sunday evening of each month, and it runs from September to June. Doors pay what you can. They have a suggested $5 to $10. Go to their Facebook page. That might be the best place to find it. And the Staircase Cafe and Theater is located at 27 Dundurn Street North in Hamilton. That's coming up this Sunday, January 5th, 7 p.m. And starting us off at here in Kingston on Tuesday, January 7th at 7 p.m., David Lyon will be launching his book called Surveillance, and you can watch for updates. There might be something already, actually, on Novel Ideas Facebook group page for that launch. And so the first launch, again, Novel Idea, here we are, starting all over again. In case you don't know, Novel Idea Bookstore is 156 Princess Street here in Kingston, and it is right on the corner of Princess and Bagot Street. And normally there would be that same night the Journey Continues monthly open mic reading that I sort of mentioned. This will be the January one of those, and it is actually going to be happening a week later because the Elm Cafe where it's held is currently closed while they're doing, in the winter, they always close for 2 or 3 weeks to do some renovations and repairs and get it all set up for the new year. So that won't be happening, but there is an open mic happening in Madoc. It's called the First Tuesday Muse. That's been going on for a bunch of years now, already two. The First Tuesday Muse is a First Tuesday, obviously, First Tuesday night of the month, open mic in, again, Madoc, with host TJ Best. They also have a Facebook page for info and updates, so just look for that, First Tuesday Muse. And I believe it's still being held at Finn's Pub and Patio, which is 231 Durham Street South in Madoc. Again, January 7th from 7 to 9 p.m. And I'm also trying to kind of stay in track with time here because we're getting fairly close. So I'm looking back and forth at the clock and this page here. So let's do this. Oh, and a week from what? Yeah, the days of the third, a week from tonight, Friday, January 10th. It's a new series. It started a few months ago, and it's run by a really cool person, Abby Miole. It's a second Friday night of the month open mic event, again, created and hosted by Abby Miole. And it says, quote, "This is a non-judgmental space open to all ages and walks of life to listen to or share music, poetry, short stories, and everyone will have 5 to 15 minutes to share. It just depends on how many people sign up that evening. I believe it is a free event as well. They may take donations too, though. Those are the events that are coming up fairly soon, but let's go ahead and move out to January 20th because there is another event here in Kingston. It's another series that's been going on for, I think, a year and a half already. I've lost track of time, but it's a multi-genre event called Quirks of Human Nature, poetry performed with improvised music, and coming up. It's this held at the Royal Tavern 2.0, which is located at 344 Princess Street here in Kingston. Again, coming up Monday, January 20th. It's a third Monday night of the month event, 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Co-hosted, I should say. Well, let's do this. Meg Freer organizes and co-hosts, and also she will also be the featured poet that evening, and music will be provided by Michael Castiles on guitar. And bonus poets that evening will also be Sue Publicover and Jan Allen. Dev Sherman's, if I didn't mention it, is the piano and also the co-MC. Again, that's coming up January 20th. And I need to start to kind of wind down now, but those are most of the events that are coming on, and I'll have another week. Next week, I'll give you some calls for submissions that are kind of approaching. So, how's that? I'm going to go ahead now and just begin to start to take us into the last segment of this show. I got the CD a number of years ago. I don't even know how long it's been. Maybe like 20 years ago. I heard it and I had to have it and I bought it, and it's Yola Tango. It's off their 1999 album called And Then Nothing Turned Itself Inside Out. Here is a song called Every Day. Have a great week, everybody.